Let me tell you of the days of high adventure.
And I'm Kevin.
And this is 6 Degrees of Schwarzenegger, the podcast where we take a long, hard look at some of our favorite action movies from the era of Arnold.
Schwarzenegger is the icon of the genre, and we're taking a deep dive into some of these 80s and 90s cult action movies and breaking them all the way down.
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum. Oh, shit.
We're back.
Eric, good to see you again,
good
my friend.
Good to see you. Yeah, it feels like it's been forever and a day.
Yeah. I'm excited to be back with you. I'm excited to be talking about this specific movie,
yes.
Which was totally off my radar. I knew it existed, and I knew generally what it was about, but I never watched it until you put it up as our next project here for the podcast. So thank you.
Yeah, well, when you said you had never seen They Live, I was kind of like, well, now it's not an option. Yeah. This has to happen.
Is another just that John Carpenter, man, was a busy motherfucker all through the 80s and the late 70s.
Yeah.
Cranking stuff out.
Oh,
I know. And quality projects.
Yeah. I mean, he had The Thing in 82. Big Trouble in Little China was 86.
He had stuff in between there.
Like, he did.
He had Halloween was 78. He had like Assault on Precinct 13 and The Fog.
That's right. Yeah.
And Christine was his.
Yeah. I don't remember.
I think Christine was him. Yeah, he was just cranking out movies that are all... He's like, what a master of just genre filmmaking.
Oh,
like,
yeah, absolutely.
Sci-fi stuff, horror stuff, and just like sort of grindhouse action.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's right in his wheelhouse. Fucking, we've left out Escape from New York.
Oh, my God. Yeah, of course. That was 81. I mean, how could we forget
that? He's just
that?
Like, yeah. He was killing the game. Yeah. Amazing, amazing films.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And he kept producing like amazing stuff for a long time afterwards. Has he done anything recently?
I think I saw his last movie that he made was one I never saw called The Ward. It was from 2010.
Oh, so
he's sort of retired more or less from directing. He still gets his name attached to some things. Sometimes you wonder if that's like, is it attached because you were attached to the original Halloween?
Right.
So you get a producer's credit on the new stuff, you know, things like that. I'm sure he got a writer's credit on the newer Halloween movies,
even though
creating characters,
right,
you know,
right,
stuff like that. But I don't think he works that much. I think he's just happy in his retirement, his golden years.
The man,
earned it. Clint Eastwood, who's like gonna work until he dies on set.
Have you seen photos of Clint Eastwood recently?
I did. That's what made me think about it. He's like, he looks like everyone's granddad, towards the end.
The pants are all the way up under his nipples, and
it's wild.
It is. It's weird to like look at a photo of Clint Eastwood at 95 and Clint Eastwood in his prime and The Good and the Bad and the Ugly, and you go, wow, it is remarkable how human bodies change over the course of their lives.
But no, this movie, having now seen it several times in the past few weeks,
Excellent
film.
This is one of my favorite John Carpenters, and actually one of the last one that I came to. We were talking about this earlier, but when I was a kid, I saw The Thing, I saw Halloween, I saw Big Trouble in Little China, I saw Escape from New York. I saw all of these movies just independently of each other and loved all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to an age where I started realizing that people actually made these movies. And then I discovered that John Carpenter had directed all of those. Oh my God, what other things has this guy directed? And They Live was one of the first one that came up.
Okay.
So I immediately read it.
Into it,
from Blockbuster on VHS, most likely.
Oh, hell yeah.
And it was like the horrible cropped 4:3 aspect ratio.
Uh-huh.
It was great. I mean, it immediately became one of my favorite of his movies. Like you said, super low budget. Right. Really wacky casting with Roddy Piper.
He had just come off, I think, doing Big Trouble in Little China, which had been probably one of his more expensive movies ever. It was like $25 million or something like that. And it borderline flopped. Like, I think it barely made its money back. And then I think he lost his sort of carte blanche to make anything he wanted. Like, someone put the reins back on him. But he seems like that kind of guy who, working under budgetary restraints, is probably good for him. Like, it makes him be more creative and more like back with his roots of storytelling, you know, just like good storytelling rather than crazy special effects and like spectacle. So
I agree.
But I dug this movie in a big way.
Yeah.
I'm glad to have seen it now. I'm glad to be going to talk about it with you and get a little tipsy tonight.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Let's get in there.
Tell them what you're drinking over there.
So I am just, I'm mixing it up a little bit. I'm drinking a simple gin gimlet.
Yeah.
With some Bombay gin, not the Sapphire, not the expensive stuff, and a little bit of Rose's lime
juice. Is the Sapphire more expensive?
The Sapphire is more expensive.
What makes it blue? What?
It's just the blue bottle. The gin is...
Oh, the gin's literally clear?
Yeah, the gin is still gin.
Okay, you can tell. I'm not a gin guy. I just see the blue bottle, I guess, and I'm like, oh, it's blue gin. Okay, fair enough.
That would be cool if it was, but alas, no.
Although it'd just be food coloring.
Yeah, it's just food coloring, yeah. But no, it's just better distilled. It's a higher quality gin. It definitely tastes better.
Oh,
but
good
I'm
to
not
know.
Gonna spend the money for it when
not
I'm just
if you're mixing
it.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
We're not. What are we made of money?
What are you drinking of? I'm certainly not.
I'm sipping on some bourbon, Bardstown Bourbon Company's Fusion Collection. It's solid. Trying to kill this bottle tonight.
Okay, all right.
It did not start out full. It's almost empty already.
I was gonna say
people,
you're gonna do a handle of a.
You're gonna say like, don't send a wellness check to my house. No thanks. But yeah, no. So I'll try to run through a little bit of like some of the people attached to the movie before we get into the plot here. So as we mentioned, directed by John Carpenter, dude's a fucking legend. Also written by Carpenter, based on a short story by Ray Nelson.
So fun fact. Apparently, Carpenter says that he didn't read the original short story. He read the graphic novel
he saw. He had a little comic book in some sci-fi anthology.
Yeah,
or something.
So he saw the comic book in a sci-fi anthology that was based on the short story, and he says that that is what actually originally inspired him, which is crazy to me.
And then for some reason, he wrote the screenplay under the pen name of Frank Armitage. Which is apparently it was a character in an H.P. Lovecraft story.
Okay.
He said.
Okay.
I think Carpenter said he was having his own like Carpenter burnout and he was just like, he was tired of seeing his name on every credit line in his movies. So that's why he wanted it to be a pen name. So it wasn't like, you know, music by Carpenter and edited by Carpenter, written by Carpenter, directed by and produced by Carpenter. Yeah.
But he does it though. I mean, that's the thing.
He does it still. Yeah. He just, I guess, I don't know why he wanted to do that, but. Respect.
Yeah, respect.
Produced by Larry Franco, music by John Carpenter and Alan Haworth.
He met on, I think, The Thing, actually.
Yeah. And he said their technique was just they would get together and just sort of jam until they hit on something that they liked. And then Carpenter said, I'm not a guy who like writes music. So this guy, Haworth or whatever, would... He'd do the sheet music and add all the little interludes and stuff like that to our basic themes we came up with, which is cool, man. Carpenter's music is always very distinctive.
Very distinctive.
And it's always very simple
and
very repetitive, but super effective for the types of movies that he does.
And They Live is not an exception to this. I mean, the theme is extremely infectious. And I mean, I can get behind it as someone who claims to be a bass player. The entire melody, the
I
entire
didn't know that
theme,
about you.
Yeah, the entire theme is based around a very simple blues bass line.
Very simple.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, at first, it took some getting used to because it literally was that little bass line is playing in every single scene.
Yep.
And I'm just like, oh, I guess we just have to lean into this. But you know what? I was watching Top Gun recently with someone who had barely ever seen it before, maybe never seen it. And like, they would just keep using the little Take My Breath Away, all through the movie.
Yeah.
To the point that it sort of like became almost a punchline. I'm like, I don't remember it being like this before, but it
That's
is.
That's so funny. Yeah. I mean, and interestingly, the tempo of the melody is timed to Roddy Piper's entrance in the first scene. The pace that his walking. And so that tempo is that his just the rate at which he walked in the first scene, which we'll get to in a moment, is what defined the entire tempo of the whole thing.
Didn't he have sort of a very deliberate, like sort of cowboyish swagger?
Oh yeah, big time.
About him.
Yeah.
But yeah, as you mentioned, casting the star Roddy Piper as Nada, though his name is never once said in the movie.
In the entire movie.
Yeah. But the name of the character in the old Nelson story was Nada, and is at the end credits it says Nada.
And in some of the behind the scenes featurettes, though, which is interesting, Roddy Piper repeatedly refers to him as John Nada for some reason, which I don't know where that came from.
I think in the screenplay that I found online, it did say John Nada.
Oh, interesting.
I think in the Nelson story, it was like George Nada, though, so that's kind of interesting. But yeah, but I think in the screenplay, it did say John Nada at some point. But,
okay.
Yeah. But Roddy Piper born Roderick Toombs, and you know, made his name as a pro wrestler.
Yeah.
Doing this like Scottish character.
Yeah. Classic old school wrestler.
So you were saying that that's where Carpenter like saw him wrestling, and
yeah. So Carpenter famously, apparently, which I didn't know until doing research for this movie, is a huge wrestling fan, and he went to WrestleMania 3, and that's where he met Roddy Piper, and they became fast friends.
Which makes total sense that he's big wrestling guy. Like that, when I heard that, it was like, oh yeah, that tracks.
That tracks. Especially when we get later in on this movie.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so years later, when he's writing, well, not too long later, but you know, a couple years later, he's writing They Live, and he's looking for a particular kind of vibe of an everyman character. Mm-hmm. And he remembered his friend Roddy Piper and kind of just offered it the role to him.
I saw on the interview, or maybe it was on the commentary, they said, like, basically he said, hey, Piper's agent was like, John Carpenter wants to have lunch.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay. And they got together and had lunch and shot the shit for a while. And then at the end, he's like, so do you want to be in my movie? Which they hadn't really talked about at all. Right. And he's like, okay, sure. Like, I think in Carpenter's mind, it was sort of an audition. Like, let me just talk with this guy and see if we get along.
Yeah.
You know? And then, so that's wild to me, but that's great. Also starring Keith David as
God.
Frank.
I never get tired of seeing Keith David in things. One of my favorite actors.
And I feel like he's one of that guy I, in my mind, that always, every time until now, would be like, is it Keith David or David Keith? His name, you know, but now I've seen it enough and familiarized myself with his work here I think I can avoid making that mistake in the future. Yeah. Keith David. What a fucking career this guy's had too. Dude was in, I always think of him first in Platoon. But he did The Thing also, which was amazing, working with Carpenter. There's Something About Mary.
Yeah.
He was like Mary's dad. What baseball? He's like, are you yelling at me in my own house? Who knew this dude is so funny?
Oh, he's a riot. I mean,
don't make me have to open a can of whoop ass on you.
He's also an acclaimed voice actor.
Dude, all those Ken Burns shits that he's done, narrating a lot of the documentaries.
I mean, any fan of Halo is going to know who Keith David is.
Uh-huh.
And then he was in
He was in Nope recently.
He was in Nope.
Was a very short part.
Unfortunately, very briefly. But he also was in season 6 of Community, which is a highly underrated season of television.
I think I haven't seen that one.
Yeah.
But dude is fucking awesome. His voice is one of the all-time great voices.
Yeah.
He also has this thing, which we'll touch on, I'm sure, as we're going through. They're like, he just conveys like a sense of, you know, working man dignity about him, like
absolutely.
A real decent human, like decency just coming off of him, you know, it's awesome. Yep. He was awesome in The Thing as like sort of the second in command, like no nonsense. Like he's just great, man. He's such a natural performer. You know, you don't feel like he's acting. You feel like he is the real guy.
Yeah. Effortless. Yeah. I totally agree with you.
He's amazing.
Yeah.
And apparently the role was written for him.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, Carpenter was like, Keith David would be perfect for this.
And he didn't audition. Like, John Carpenter called him up, said, hey, you want to be in my movie? And he said, okay, and that was it.
And he said he wanted someone who wouldn't be a sidekick,
right?
But he'd be like an equal partner of the guy. And I think they nailed that dynamic, because like, if anyone is the brains of the outfit, it's Frank.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And Frank seems like, honestly, he seems like he's sort of the one who's in charge and not as just sort of like the brawling muscle,
right?
You know,
he sort of figures out what's going on. But then Frank was like, okay, now we got to deal with this. Like, you stumbled into something. I'll take it over from here.
And then the only other cast member that we'll touch on up front here is Meg Foster, who plays the character Holly. I only know her really from Masters of the Universe, is playing like the evil woman in Masters of the Universe. But she's got those eyes.
Yeah, she does.
Striking, like,
yeah.
Electric blue eyes.
Interestingly, Carpenter found her from a Canadian movie that she did that was about a cult, and I'm not remembering the name of it off the top of my head.
Was it like a horror flick?
It was like a thriller. It wasn't a horror movie. It was more like a thriller, but he saw that movie and he saw her eyes in that movie and like, oh yeah, I definitely want to work with her.
Yeah.
Again, she did not audition for the role. He called her up and offered her the role.
Well, her performance in this is interesting.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it.
We'll get to it,
like,
for sure.
Yeah. But I also saw in one of the interviews on my Blu-ray that Carpenter just spoke about how much he loves sci-fi more so than horror.
Yeah.
Like that he thinks that it is an easier vehicle for making a statement about like conveying some idea, like a theme about politics or society or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
He also had said that he thought of this as being very similar to The Thing, and that it's like about like there being like a hidden enemy in your midst, like hiding in plain sight, that, and then the paranoia that comes from that.
Which he said he kind of weaves into almost all of his movies to a certain degree.
Oh, yeah?
That's like, it's just sort of like part of his kind of DNA to a certain extent.
Well, for me, I was telling someone about, so I don't think you watched the newer season of True Detective.
No, I didn't see
Jodie Foster there in the snow.
No, I didn't see
that. It's got big The Thing vibes, his version of The Thing.
Yeah.
And big, there was that one X-Files episode where they were like at that snow lab.
Ice, season one.
Yeah. It was also a classic episode.
Yep.
It's like, but that, the True Detective was sort of reminded me of The Thing, but then this friend of mine who loved the True Detective show, you've never seen The Thing. And I would say, oh, well, wow. You gotta watch The Thing, dude.
Yeah, you gotta watch The Thing.
Because it's, I think The Thing was like, and especially the original The Thing, was like a communist, like a thing about like their secret communists hiding among us, and then everyone starts turning on each other, you know, whatever, but especially the original, but even the newer one, I think also was sort of like, we were still in that peak era, like Red Dawn, Soviet, communist scare era.
I mean, 82, we were still a decade away from the end of the Cold War.
Yeah,
basically.
So, we were in the peak of it. Like, you know, everyone was worried like War Games and Red Dawn and those type of movies were coming out. Like,
yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely.
It was definitely Soviet and Americans had like cranked up the temperature on the on the Cold War. So,
yeah.
But this one fits right in that same sort of concept of like there being just a secret conspiracy that we're not aware of, like, and their enemies are in our midst. Sort of thing. It's pretty fucking great.
It is. I mean, it is. It's and you know, this was a very political movie for John Carpenter. He obviously made this, and he's very open about this, in response to Reagan. Like, he hated President Reagan, and I'm not going to weigh in one way or the other. It's not relevant, but he hated Reagan and wanted to. He just like they live kind of. Was born out of that need to express how frustrated he was with the way everything was going under his presidency.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting and it comes through. I mean, this is at least for as long as
we'll
I've been doing this.
We'll touch on that as we go along and at the end as well. But
this is the most political movie that we've done together.
Oh, for sure.
You know,
for sure. Like, I was not prepared for that aspect of the story. And it's a movie that another theme that'll keep coming up as we go through is like, this movie feels even like more
contemporary now.
Today than it probably could have possibly been in 88.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But yeah, let's dig in, man.
Yeah, I'm ready to do it. Well, so here we go. The Universal Animation comes up, followed by Alive Films, They Live.
That was like the production house that he was had a deal with or something?
Second and last movie he did with them.
Okay, I think he had like full creative control over the movies. What was... anyway, it doesn't matter what the other one was, but
I don't remember it off the top of my head.
I don't either, but I think it was whatever he did right after Big Trouble in Little China and before this.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think he's a guy who needs full control of his projects to really execute his vision.
So, really fun shot. We open on a bunch of graffiti with a bunch of different things all over it. They Live is spray painted on it.
It was cool,
emerges,
wasn't it?
Yeah, emerges from the wall. John Carpenter's They Live as the credit, right?
And I spent so long staring at that mural, like trying to find the secret meaning in it and how it was going to like foreshadow the story. And I just think that it doesn't.
No, I think that just the production designer just spray painted They Live onto
an existing mural.
On existing graffiti.
You're vandalizing the graffiti, sir. Stop it.
But and then as we were talking about, that blues line immediately starts up, like right from that opening moment, right? Mm-hmm. Really establishes, I mean, everything about this first shot, because the camera pans over, we see trains rolling by slowly. We've got that synth blues melody going. And then here comes Nada approaching camera, stepping over the train tracks.
Yeah.
He's got his like bedroll above his backpack, wearing the flannels. I mean, like the whole thing. He is the definition of the working poor everyman kind of guy.
He reminded me of John Rambo in First Blood. Like when we see him sort of 100%. Wandering along, like clearly a dude who's the, you know, the prototype drifter.
Yeah.
Like living a hard life or whatever and riding the rails or whatever he's out here doing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But except that I think that for Carpenter, this movie was also a counterpoint to like Rambo 2 and 3, like that had become these big sort of jingoistic rah-rah, we're big and roided up and we're going to kick everyone's ass.
100%.
And,
this was absolutely a repudiation of that. But it's interesting too, because he jumps right into it, because he starts walking into downtown LA and then is immediately sort of like either impressed or overwhelmed by the concrete spectacle that is the city.
Right.
And, you know, we get this tableau, the streets are crowded with homeless people and panhandlers and, right, I mean, like, immediately he steps into an unemployment office looking for work.
Well, I think it was, like, the dichotomy of, like, he's marveling at this very rich city that's then crawling with homeless people.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and it's like there's the wealth of this city, and then everyone who's on the streets here is poor.
And it's interesting, too, because, like, the unemployment office is so densely packed versus the sparseness when he's outside every time, right?
There was a PA announcement going on in there about, like, the food stamp service has been suspended.
Yep.
And it's just like, oh, yeah, it's like, to not to get too political, but it's like there's certain people that want to end these entitlement programs for people and stuff. And that was reminding me, like, oh, that's been a thing, I guess, for 30 plus years.
30 plus years.
At least.
It's just crazy. So he looks at the job board, doesn't see anything immediately, and he cuts to him talking to this old crone who is, I guess, managing his...
So I thought for sure that was maybe the woman from Beetlejuice, you know, the one who... She had that same vibe.
Yeah.
I looked up and it was not her.
Okay.
The only thing, this woman has been in like a million episodes of Matlock playing a judge. Like, she was a recurring character on Matlock's.
Oh,
but she was not
amazing.
The woman from Beetlejuice. I would have loved it if she was, though.
That's so funny. He's looking for work, and he's been out in Denver for 10 years, but all the work out there dried up.
Yeah.
And so it drove him west.
You made that comment about like 14 banks collapsed.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure, what does that mean, like a run on the banks, sort of like depression era?
I think that's what it's kind of implying.
Okay.
Yeah. But we don't ever come back to that, though. But it is, I feel like that he was sort of trying to do a little bit of world building and imply that there are other things going on around the world. So to establish that this wasn't just a thing that was happening in Los Angeles.
Oh, for sure. For sure. It's that's well laid in that it's at least all across America.
Right. Exactly. So he doesn't get any work, and we go back to him just wandering the streets of LA, and he stumbles across a blind preacher who is just,
I didn't pick up right away that he was blind. I didn't pick up it until later on.
Oh yeah.
But I was just like, oh, okay. Did that register for you like the first time you saw him?
I mean, I saw the movie originally like 20 years ago.
So you
don't
knew
remember,
in your
but
mind.
I knew he was blind.
Okay.
When I was watching it, you know, recently,
you didn't
I was
like have the dark glasses
myself.
On or like anything necessarily, but it makes sense for him to be blind.
Yeah,
especially with the nature of his character, as we'll discover.
Right, exactly. But yeah, so he has a, and it's a really prescient kind of, it almost foreshadows the whole movie to a certain extent.
But he's part of the rebellion,
yeah,
as
he
it
is
were.
Ultimately
we
part
don't
of the
know
rebellion.
That yet, but,
right,
he's trying to get the message out,
right,
I guess.
Right. You know, they use their tongues to deceive you. Venom is on their lips. Uh-huh. Their mouths are full of bitterness and curses. The fear of God is not before their eyes.
Mm-hmm. Which sounds like crazy preacher talk.
Right, no, it's totally appropriate crazy preacher talk, but you know, we won't read the whole thing.
No, you should, because this is where it gets more relevant,
all
I
right.
think.
So anyway, so then he goes on, is like, they have taken the hearts and minds of our leaders.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Okay.
They have blinded us to the truth. Our human spirit is corrupted. Why do we worship greed? Outside the limit of our sight, they're feeding off us.
Yes.
Perched on top of us from birth to death are our owners. They have us. They control us. They are our masters. Wake up. They're all around you.
He's like summing it all up.
The whole conspiracy. Here. And it's funny.
It's not the most convincing presentation to win people over to your side. It's coming off like the crackpot, street corner preacher.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But he's spitting nothing but facts.
Spitting nothing but the truth, which I think, you know, is really driven home when the police show up. And they're clearly there to deal with the preacher, in my opinion. I don't know why else
they
would have
been
there.
No, yeah, I think they don't show that.
Right, but they don't show it.
It's very clear. Not as like, I'm not getting involved in this,
and he moves on.
I know what they do to drifters around here.
Exactly. So he's walking down the street, and he passes a store window filled with TVs, turned to cable 54, which is a channel that will show up multiple times over the course of the movie. And it's showing this like really patriotic kind of commercial.
Yeah.
And then it shows a man that's just like literally staring at the TV like a
completely
zombie.
Motionless.
Yeah, exactly.
It was real creepy.
Mm-hmm.
There's a creepy vibe already going on.
Yeah.
Carpenter's like a craftsman of a filmmaker, you know what I mean? Also, someone pointed out that like the way that the Mount Rushmore was lit, like it made it look like the presidents each like were wearing sunglasses, like their eyes were really blacked out. I don't know if that was intentional or not.
I don't know, but some people speculate that they did that on purpose to imply, even specifically with Lincoln, apparently it was the most significant.
Okay.
It was that this was a liberation, like we were about to be emancipated from our controllers.
I could see it, man. I give Carpenter credit. He's a deep thinker.
Yeah. So he finds his way to a homeless camp. Nada finds his way to a homeless camp. And he...
he's by like the proverbial barrel fire.
Yeah. He's literally by the barrel fire with the fingerless gloves and everything. And he watches through someone's window and there's a woman on TV talking about how she dreams of being rich and famous and living young and being young forever, which is just like, I mean, it's like, how did you get in a time machine and look at celebrity culture from 2024?
That was so off-putting. It was so realistic.
Ridiculous.
Like influencer culture is like,
oh my God.
I just want to be generically famous.
Yeah.
I don't care what it's for. I just want people to see me getting out of limousines and just love me and want to be me.
I'm like,
this is so gross, like grotesque to me, but also so... there's no way that this is not more relevant now than it was in 88. Like, he nailed it.
Unbelievably, just like right on the head. I had completely forgotten that bit. I was like, oh my God.
It was so real.
Yeah.
That I
so
blew real. My mind. Like,
So then we cut to a police copter circling overhead. Again, coming back to sort of the observers, the ever watchful eye.
That's a recurring theme, right? There's is there a heavily policed like surveillance state that they're living in.
Really? I mean, it's just
is more accurate today than it was in 88.
I mean, at this point, I don't think Nada has said more than three lines of dialogue, right? And we're a good 3 or 4 minutes into the movie at this point.
Yeah.
Maybe even closer to 10 at this point. And it's just crazy how much world building is just being done passively as he takes in the city of Los Angeles.
I'll go on right now and say the movie we just did was Action Jackson.
Yeah.
Came out the same year.
Yeah.
Similar range of budgets, probably kind of lower budget, though this was even cheaper than Action Jackson.
Oh, wow,
And this movie is like got so much more like just craftsmanship about it is all I can say than Action Jackson did. Like, this is telling, they've built more of a world in 5 or 10 minutes here than Action Jackson does, I think, in the entire film.
Yeah, I know. It is.
And this movie has something to say. It has a point of view that I'm not sure what Action Jackson was even about. I'm still not sure.
No,
I don't want to talk about it for another 5 hours, it blows my mind that these two movies were same type of money behind them, made for the same audience.
Yep.
And can be so drastically different.
I know. It's just crazy.
Al Leong is in both of them. We'll get to Al Leong later.
I was like, oh my God. We'll get to down to him briefly later. But
yeah.
So anyway, the next day, Nada finds his way to a construction site and he's looking for work. And the guy's like, oh, I'm not so sure about you. He's like, yeah, but I've got my own tools.
So this has always been Nada's livelihood, as like a guy
a
handyman or a construction guy working with his hands.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And the foreman says that it's a union job. And so Nada's like, well, then sign me up.
Right.
All right, great. I'm a part. So later he's shirtless, of course.
Fucking guy was yoked up.
Dude, what a body. Holy moly. He was not fucking around at all. And he's just doing hard labor. I don't know, digging holes.
Yeah. That's such a weird thing. I'm like, this is, they had bulldozers in the 80s.
Right,
but I guess,
exactly. I don't know.
They're employing basically homeless people, I guess. Then they're probably paying them dirt, you know?
Nothing.
Like, it's shitty.
So finally we see Keith David, Frank's character, Keith David's character, Frank, and he's on site doing the same sort of menial digging holes work.
I think he was swinging a pickaxe.
Yeah, I think he
which
was.
Which I'm like, is he an old timey prospector? Like, I don't know what you'd be doing on the construction site with a pickaxe, like
I'm
busting
for
rocks.
Goals in this foundation.
Know, it's nuts.
It was weird. I mean, it's completely irrelevant what the actual work was.
We see they're doing backbreaking physical labor.
And that's what matters.
That's
right?
What it is. Yeah. These are working men.
So it's quitting time now, and the foreman is angrily shouting at Nada. He's like, you can't sleep here. There's no sleeping on this site, so you park your ass someplace else tonight.
Which, what? Was there even an indication that he was planning to sleep there?
No idea. But I mean, to Roddy Piper's credit, he looked just about as confused as I was when this line was said.
I was asking myself, why is dude being like that? Like, it's just, maybe just to see like how heartless people are in this society.
I think so, because this is a theme that comes back over and over again, is the heartlessness of the society. And just like, even though, you know, Nada was so willing to join the union, he does the whole backbreaking labor for the day. The foreman still could not give a shit less about it.
Right.
Right.
It's not like he's unrolling his bedroll or anything. Exactly. It was just strangely out of line.
So Nada asks when he's going to get paid, and the foreman says Thursday, and then just walks off.
Which, we don't have a clue what day of the week it is.
We don't even know.
Yeah.
So Frank approaches and says, "Hey, look, if you need a place to stay, I can get you. I know a place where I can get you a hot shower and a meal."
Yeah.
And Nada doesn't respond, and Frank goes, "Fine, fuck you, whatever," and walks away, which I think is a perfectly reasonable response.
Nada's just there with his mullet blowing in the wind. That was one epic mullet. That was man, Kurt Russell on his prime mullet. Yeah. He's like, I don't have Kurt Russell for this movie, but I do need you to grow that mullet out. So yeah, that was the working man's mullet.
The working man's mullet.
So, it was the Joe Dirt mullet, essentially. It really was. It was insane. It was the most mulletiest mullet I think I've seen in a movie.
I mean, aside from Joe Dirt.
Yeah. That was an ironic mullet. This was an unironic mullet.
Right. So Frank walks off the site, and then he notices that Nada's following him and slowly creeps up. Like, he's following closer and closer.
He's kind of like a stray dog or something.
Exactly.
In a picture. Yeah.
Yeah. So Frank finally stops and says he doesn't like being followed unless he knows why. And then Nada says he doesn't like to join up with anybody unless he knows where they're going. So it's like a little witty repartee right from the go.
Although he did tell him where he was going.
Yeah, I know. I was just like, all right, whatever. Okay. And like, maybe he just didn't believe him when he said it.
Sure, I don't trust people. I get that.
And he does. He does come across as sort of like he doesn't trust people.
Yeah,
he's very cautious of trusting.
Well, like a stray dog. I don't just trust just anyone. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
I'll follow you, but at a distance.
So Frank smiles, and they're clearly cut from the same cloth. And so they walk together.
I thought they had a good chemistry.
Oh, they did. After this movie, Keith David and Roddy Piper were fast friends. Friends forever after that.
I love that.
Yeah.
I was, I think it was on the commentary track that I was listening to where Roddy Piper was talking about just how generous Keith David was, that he almost like was acting as an acting coach for him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he'd help him work through scenes and figure out like sort of what his real motivation was in each of the scenes. And I'm like, that's something you didn't have to do.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, that's just a stand up move from a stand up guy.
Oh, totally.
I love that.
So, I mean, you know, my understanding is Keith David was doing a lot of stage theater.
Yeah.
Before
he was an acting teacher as well. Like,
exactly.
Teaching voice. He was teaching like voice work for people and stuff. Yeah, I love that.
So, I mean, I that's really cool. I mean, just my appreciation for Keith David just constantly is always on the rise.
Yeah, dude's awesome.
But anyway, so Frank takes Nada to the shanty town where everybody just like it's a true melting pot, right? Mm-hmm. All ages, all races, everybody is sort of just living together in this small little shanty town.
Apparently, there's a lot of like real homeless people that Carpenter, like,
he paid them
money, fed them. Mm-hmm. Like, that's awesome on mm-hmm. Carpenter's part mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah. So there's food getting prepared. Nada's starving. So Frank introduces Nada to the man who's running the place, Gilbert. And mm-hmm. Gilbert can find him whatever he needs, basically.
Yeah, right.
So now we introduce Gilbert, who will be a character we come back to multiple times.
That dude was mad familiar.
He super was.
I'm like, what do I know him from?
Yeah.
It took me a minute, and So I know him as being like, he was the bartender in the Redneck Bar in 48 Hours.
I don't remember that.
The one that's like, you know, it's all a bunch of hillbillies, and Eddie Murphy comes in.
Okay.
And he's like, I guess you probably want to drink a Black Russian. And Eddie's like, Black Russian. I get it, because I'm black. that's what I know him from, but he's a John Carpenter regular.
Oh,
like, he's been in like six different Carpenter movies when I studied his IMDb. Oh, he was also the fucking soccer coach in The Karate Kid.
Oh, he was?
I would never know, because that guy didn't get a close-up or anything.
Oh,
but he's
God.
Like, hey, we don't deal with that kind of crap around here. Like, broke up the fight, you know, Daniel and the Cobra Kai.
Maybe it was.
That's awesome.
That's so
instantly
crazy.
Like, I'm a fan. You told me he's in Karate Kid, I'm a fan.
But I mean, I always, whenever I see people like that and they're immediately familiar and I don't know the name, I'm like, okay, you're a working actor.
Absolutely.
I've seen you in a million things. Yeah, exactly. So Gilbert asks if Nada knows how to use those tools, and he's welcome to join the community for free as long as he's willing to pay, you know, do the repairs.
It's awesome.
That seems fair. So Frank leads Nada to the food line. There's a dozen people waiting for food, and they get like just, you know, stews, green, whatever. Just like it's just basically like food kitchen kind of.
Some time must have passed because Gilbert was also up at the front of the, like slinging that slop.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so Frank and Nada like sit away from the other, and they're just kind of munching away. And Frank tells Nada that he has a wife and kid back in Detroit that he hasn't seen in 6 months. Mm-hmm. And he left them to go look for work, which apparently this is based on experiences that John Carpenter had with people like that.
Okay.
He said like,
yeah, like the working poor, they call
working
them.
Poor, right? Yeah. Exactly. These people
who wanted to work and had jobs, but they couldn't afford first and last month's rent. So you couldn't really get a place.
Exactly. Man. And so they became migrant workers within their own country, which is just crazy.
And Keith David is like amazing at doing this sort of work on screen. Like his performance, mm-hmm. it was just so realistic. It broke your heart to hear him mm-hmm. telling his story, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't say enough good things about him.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So Frank tells Nada that basically what happened is the steel mills started shutting down and laying everybody off. Mm-hmm. And he laments that the workers, they gave their companies a break when the times were tough, and then the management gave themselves raises and bought foreign cars, which I thought was a really, again,
it's too real. It's more real now than it was then.
Yeah.
However real it was back then, it's like we had all these bank bailouts and all the CEOs gave themselves massive bonuses.
Well, I mean, like not even forget all the steel tariffs that started, that started happening, which raised the price of domestic steel, right? Yeah. It's crazy, right? Like
it's nuts.
Down to even the actual like industry.
So, like, yeah, people are making more money, but it's not the working class people.
Exactly. And then one of my favorite lines in the whole movie, and there are so many good lines in this movie, the golden rule, he who has the gold makes the rules.
I'm like, that shit hits hard.
Yeah.
It's too real.
Yeah. So Frank mutters that if things continue this way, there should be a revolution.
I'm ready to rock with Frank right now. He's like, you know, if they do that, I'm ready to put a fucking brick through their foreign car's windshield. Like, hell yes, Frank.
Nada's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Slow down a little bit. Slow down.
It's interesting. Yeah, Nada's not been sort of radicalized,
right.
I guess, yet.
Right, exactly. And I think, I mean, even though, and this is an interesting factoid. So I guess Piper had recently been married. And so he refused to remove his wedding ring.
Yeah.
They just don't address it.
Like, we see that a lot I guess it's never said that he's not married.
No.
Or that he hadn't at one point been married, his character or something.
I mean, like what I projected on it is his wife died at some point and it cut him loose. Like, have you ever seen American Nomad with Frances McDormand?
Nomadland.
Thank you.
Yes.
That's what I meant.
Yeah.
Same premise. Her husband died and she just became a nomad. That's kind of like what I projected onto Nada, basically. Yeah. He lost his wife and just became a drifter as a result.
I have another theory we can touch on a little bit later about what may have gone down with the Nada.
Within the fiction of the world.
the backstory that we never get any details on.
So now later it's dusk and Frank walks Nada through the camp. And says that the powers that be have everyone else playing a game. He explains that they put everyone at the starting line, and the goal is to just get through life, right? Which is, I think, pretty appropriate. But instead of working together to succeed, everyone tries to hurt each other to get ahead.
Also, that's fucking real life, man.
I know. It's more true now than it ever has been, honestly.
It's like there's the, you know, the analogy of like, I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's like a political cartoon, but you know, you got like the rich fat cat with like, who's got like eight cookies or whatever. And there's one cookie there and two poor people. And he's like, hey, look, he's trying to take your cookie.
Yeah.
Instead of people sharing the wealth and let's all lift ourselves up together. It's like, no, everyone's being pitted against each other.
Yeah.
By the mysterious they.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, but Nada doesn't seem to agree with Frank's philosophy, though, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
He says that he believes in an honest day's work for an honest day's pay, and that if he keeps his head down, works hard, success will come to him, which...
That's the dream that we're sold, right?
Exactly. Just, you know, play your part, and then you'll be successful in the end.
Yeah, work hard and keep your head down, and you'll follow the rules, and you'll find great success.
Right. And he says, I believe in America. I follow the rules. Everyone's got their own hard times these days, sort of coming from the perspective that everybody's suffering in their own way and who am I to judge, right? Which I thought, oh, okay, all right.
Yeah.
So he really is coming from a true neutral position. He's not a skeptic, quite frankly, at the start.
No, yeah, he's like, he believes in America,
right,
still. Yeah.
Right, absolutely. So night falls, and Nada's sitting alone playing harmonica. Perfect.
Apparently he did his own harmonica playing.
Oh, really? So, okay, yeah. Well, there you go.
But he's really, I feel like he's fully embraced the hobo lifestyle. You
know? Which, interestingly,
he's train jumping, he's like playing the harmonica, I mean, look, he's doing the barrel fire thing.
Yeah, that's right. He's got it locked down. He's
I thought
practicing.
They would give him like the little bindle stick to walk around with his little thing. Why would anyone carry their shit like that?
I don't know, so man. Weird. But it's real though. I mean, I've seen photos of like understand. You know, like hobos like
just tied
around.
Up in a little blanket on
yeah,
a stick.
It's so weird.
It's so strange.
Anyway.
But he's leaning into it.
He really is leaning into it hard.
Yeah.
So he wanders through the camp late at night, and he finds a couple of dudes watching TV, and then the signal starts getting staticky, and this very, like, you know, academic motherfucker shows up on screen, and he starts reading a manifesto. And the guys watching the TV complain that these hackers, which I thought was an interesting word.
I didn't know that word was around already.
Yeah, I guess it was. Cool. Keep interrupting the TV signal. And the man on the TV warns that everyone is living in an artificially induced state of consciousness, something like being asleep, which
interesting,
which is an interesting thing to say, right? And he says that 8 months ago, which is a very specific time frame.
Recently, yeah, but
so it's very recently, a group of scientists discovered a signal that has been disrupting people's thinking. So they have just
so that's when the rebellion started,
right,
I guess.
Basically, yeah.
Okay.
And the guy goes, the poor and the underclass are growing. Racial justice and human rights are non-existent. They have created a repressive society. We are their unwitting accomplices. And
could that be more current to today?
Once again, like, and Nada notices that the street preacher from earlier he's actually mouthing along with the words, like he already knows what he's going to say.
Yeah,
right?
It's odd.
Which is interesting. And then the man continues on the TV and he says, we have been lulled into a trance. They have made us indifferent to ourselves, to others. We are focused only on our own gain, which again,
dropping like it's a barrage of truth bombs
everywhere. So the hack TV signal, it's still cutting in and out. Like someone's got to find the tracking knob and fix that shit. But it's causing everybody who's watching it headaches.
Right.
Mr. Academia continues and he says, they are safe as long as they are not discovered. That is their primary method of survival. They keep us asleep, keep us selfish, keep us sedated.
Dude.
I mean.
Straight facts, homie.
Look. So
the movie is really philosophical.
It really is. Yeah.
More so even than other John Carpenter movies.
I mean, again, this was absolutely a repudiation on the Reagan administration, right?
Yeah.
Like he absolutely had an axe to grind, and he's very clear about that when he went into making this movie. So in terms of any sort of subtext for commentary, this is the most overt of his movies up to this point, I feel like. But at this point, one of the men watching gets up and changes the channel on the TV. Blow it out your ass, he says to the TV. And if I'm not mistaken, that guy, he was in Back to the Future, right?
Yes.
He was red. He was red in Back to the Future.
The homeless man.
That's right. Which I thought was great. I couldn't believe it.
We normally don't like to get into the whole spoilers on the podcast.
Yeah.
But. Spoiler alert, this guy winds up being part of the conspiracy later on. So do you reckon he's already been corrupted at this point? Or did he not get corrupted until later on?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I think that he was in it all the way from the beginning.
That would kind of make more sense as we work our way through.
Yeah.
And it would kind of make sense why he's sort of like poo-pooing on this, you know, the hacker signal.
Absolutely. He is. The sense that I got is like to get, well, I don't want, well, let's come back to it.
We'll work, there will be opportunities.
But yes, I do believe that he was a part of it from the very beginning.
Okay.
Yeah, that is my take on it.
I agree with it having on second or third viewings, I'm like, I feel like he has always been a part of
this. Yes, that was my thought as well. Okay,
cool.
So, all right, we'll come back to him. He comes back. Don't worry. We haven't seen the last of Red from Back to the Future.
No.
So then Nada notices that Gilbert is speaking to the street preacher. But he can't, from where he is, he can't hear what's going on. But he sees that Gilbert takes the preacher by the arm and leads him towards a nearby church, which I thought was interesting that the first introduction to this kind of the, because we'll find pretty quickly that this is the House of the Rebellion.
Yeah.
That they set it in a church, right? They could have been anywhere, but a church is where they decide to set it up in. And while Gilbert is leading the preacher away, other people are watching the TV, and they're now completely engrossed in the new show that they're watching.
I looked it up, and it was an old 50s B-movie called The Monolith Monsters.
I love that title.
In which the monster was like a space rock that like came down from space and started growing. And if people touched it, they would turn to stone. And
that seems kind of fun.
It's any number of like MST3K type movies, you know? I'm sure that's the shit Carpenter grew up watching.
Absolutely. 100%. I mean, if he didn't watch all of those movies, it would blow my mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Gilbert and the preacher, they're having a disagreement as they're being, you know, as Gilbert's leading the preacher away.
So there's obviously something strange going on here.
Right. We don't know what's going on, but there is. Yeah, like and Nada picks up on this pretty quick.
Yeah.
Like something is not right about what's going on here.
Yeah.
Because he experiences the headache too. He notices the lip syncing. He notices all of this. So he's pretty observant about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
The next morning, Nada encounters a very tired looking Gilbert as he's exiting the church. And Nada remarks that the choir practice ran a little late last night.
Right.
Gilbert says that the church lets them use their kitchen, and Nada's response is, until 4 a.m? And Gilbert goes, hey, we're taking care of a lot of people here.
So Nada stayed up until 4 a.m, like keeping an eye on things?
I guess that's what they're implying. It's like, this is interesting. I'm going to see what's going on.
I got the impression that Nada was on his way to work, but they don't actually show that. But he had like the tool belt slung over his shoulder, and he was in a different version of his uniform, which is like a different flannel and jeans.
Yep.
But yeah, I got the impression that they never show him at work, but I have the impression that he was on his way back to the construction site or something.
That was basically what I had just assumed, that he watched to a point, was like, okay, I got to work tomorrow. I went to bed at 4 a.m.
I get
2 hours of sleep. But anyway, so Gilbert gives him a smile and walks off, but Nada remains very suspicious.
Yeah. It's a good hook.
It's a great hook.
Yeah.
We're deep into They Live at this point.
Yeah, dude.
But I think we're going to call it for this episode.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's put a pin in it for this week.
Yep. Exactly.
But we'll be back, because now we can start discovering what exactly is going on here.
Yeah, the world building is far from over, but we have got our foot deeply in the door on this. So.
Absolutely. So thanks, everyone, for listening. And, it's a pleasure, as always. And we'll be back.